Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
A very jolly welcome to episode number 538 of the Minter Dial podcast. My name is Minter Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on the network, please go and visit evergreenpodcast.com. So this week's interview is with Lisa Leong. Lisa's an ABC broadcaster in Australia, host of Sundays with Lisa Leong on ABC Radio Melbourne, host of This Working Life podcast on ABC Radio National, and co-author with Monique Ross of the book This Working Life, How to Navigate Your Career in Uncertain Times. In this conversation with Lisa, we discuss a central tenet of her book, Work-Life Coherence, how to have ambition and manage the stresses that come with it, how to forge meaningful change, the power of vulnerability, how to design and manage a portfolio career, and uncovering one's personal values. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. And if you have a moment, please go and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Lisa Leong, how lovely to have you on my show. Great to have you in from piped in from down south. ABC broadcaster. A woman of many talents, and most recently, author of This Working Life, How to Navigate Your Career in Uncertain Times. Thank you for coming on the show. Lisa, in your own words, who are you?
I'm a lover, not a fighter, Minter. You know that. I think in essence, you know, I'm someone who's really curious and I love other human beings, and I think I try and see everyone as whole human beings. So that's me in a nutshell.
Well, it seems like the idea of knowing who you are is a central tenet of your book. And how do you decide that you actually know who you are?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's the not knowing. So I do see my life as being in a lab. I say every day is lab day, where what you get in your experiences are like data, and you look at each experience and you say, what did that, what is the lesson in that? Whether it be my preferences or what I would never do again if it was a project that you didn't like doing, or if it is a project that you love doing, what was it about that? What's the data there that shows me that it lights me up and I'm in flow? And so with that curiosity and that lens of every day is lab day, that's how I figure out who I am. But I feel like who I am changes over time, you know, whether it be, you know, the young me or the older me.
The tired and that's you, part the energetic of the, you.
Yeah, that's why the work is never done, is it, Minter?
Well, so you describe this lab day thanks to your prior career as a lawyer. What does that technically mean, making a lab day? So you have this notion of listening in to what you're feeling. How does that go about?
Yeah. So really this experimental mindset comes from my time, as you intimated, studying science law, and which was a really unusual combination that was offered at Melbourne University, but there was only a handful of us who would do it. Now, the lawyer's mindset and the science mindset are a little bit different, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I was actually really bad in the lab. So I'm like a failed scientist in a way because I did organic chemistry. It's a lot like cooking and I can't cook. So I actually had one lab evacuated, Winter, because I was basically doing a lab experiment and then created a poisonous gas instead of So the lab got evacuated.
Run for your lives.
Run for your life. Lisa Leong is in the lab. But the one thing I picked up, Minter, is that, you know, when you run an experiment, how you've got a hypothesis and basically you're testing it. That's the whole point. And when you hit a positive result, it actually means you need to keep on searching. You haven't reached the edge of the hypothesis. So actually when an experiment fails, it's kind of richer because you go, ooh, okay, I've hit the edge of something. So then you go and it's actually quite useful because that's a boundary. So the experiment fails, you don't fail. It's not that you as a scientist are a failure. And I think that's a really important point to pause on because in life, when we have a failed experiment, so when something goes terribly wrong, often we turn on ourselves, I am a failure. Whereas what I learned through science is that no, I am not a failure, right?
Right. It's the experiment that's failed.
The experiment fails. So let's then extrapolate. So if every day is lab day in our own lives, Minter, then every interaction, everything that happens to me, I'm going, how fascinating. And that's a little catchphrase that I learned from Ben Zander. He's the conductor, a world famous conductor. And if you think about high powered stakes, right? Yeah. How fascinating. And I love that. Of course, we all want to be as excellent as we can be. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you've just got to allow yourself to be human. Maybe that's ultimately what it boils down to.
Yeah, a friend, Becky, wrote a book called Enough. The title is When is Enough Enough?
Yeah.
And that idea of not, because you want to be excellent, but you also can't be perfect. And yes, you want to be excellent, but you've got other things you want to do. And things crop up and unexpected things happen. So how do you balance that notion, let's say, of ambition, which certainly underwrites a lot of your career, with that ability to accept imperfection, enoughness?
It's another catchphrase that I learned from a friend of mine who's a Baroque musician, best in the world, once again. And she learned in her world that this phrase of everything matters and nothing matters. So I love complexity, by the way. So for me, you know, there is no black and white. So if we go with nuance, then everything matters and nothing matters. So yes, we strive for that, you know, the perfect run, if it is on Baroque viola. For me, it's you know, the perfect radio broadcast, you know, an interview that goes swimmingly well. Of course, we're aiming for that. We're preparing for that. And then nothing matters. At the end of the day, we're a human being on a spinning planet. you know, there is nothing more that we need to be other than in that moment, just being and enjoying.
If I take it the other way around, if everything doesn't matter,
yeah,
then it's like, well, who cares?
Why bother? Exactly. So that's why it does matter. But then at the end of the day, that's why it's not, you know, even when I was writing the book, it is not a book that tells you the answer, Minter, right? It just helps you ask better questions. And, you know, my love is interviewing. And at the heart of interviewing is asking a genuine question with curiosity and openness, and then opening every pore to the answer that the person is giving you and letting that sit, kind of. And so in that asking that question, you know, that is the essence really for me.
Well, there are certainly several books that talk about the art of asking questions. And maybe the thought I had going back to your scientist, lawyer, by, I don't know, different two different careers, something that both of them tend to do well is ask questions.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And in science, there's a hypothesis. And so what I love about that is, once again, you're holding it lightly, aren't you? You're asking that question of the experiment and saying, could this possibly be true and why don't I test that, right? And then observe the data. So beautiful. Now, in law, you know, it's critical thinking. So, you know, and what's really interesting, if you boil law down, is very often we're looking at every infinite possibility, predominantly of what might go wrong, but you can actually apply it, the critical thinking, to extrapolate, okay, what are all of the things that could happen here? So you are taught to think critically. And I think, you know, that's the part that I found does intersect when it comes to science and law. I mean, it was a great course to do, program to do, in terms of learning different paradigm and how to think.
Yeah, and to speak on your feet perhaps as well. I suppose that's if you're in court. One of the expressions you say, and it reminds me of another friend of mine, Ray Shanahan, to name her, she talks about holding things lightly, and you've already used the expression. And in the book you write, I held the radio gigs lightly. This idea of holding things lightly, it feels like that's the middle ground of it. Everything matters and nothing matters.
Yeah. There was a phrase that we were taught when I was learning radio at the Australian Film, Television and Radio School. The head of radio, Steve Ahern, gave us this. He said, who will you be when the on-air light switches off? So the on-air light, it comes on when you're broadcasting, to indicate, tell people, you know, be quiet, we're broadcasting now. So it does represent the you as a radio professional. Now, in radio, of course, we have personas. We become maybe fairly well known on the radio. If you identify with that, you know, is what Steve was saying, if you think that you're Lethal Lisa on SAFM commercial radio station and you identify with that person, that's quite a dangerous place to be, because if that on-air light switches off, when that on-air light switches off, in whatever role you are, whether you're the CEO, a manager, a worker, if you identify solely with your job and you lose that job, then you could lose your sense of self. And actually, that's not what life is. You are not your labels. That's an important point.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not just it's the expression within the radio life, but it's something that I see a lot in any business where people identify with, make extrinsic importance about my title, my pay and all this. And I think it feels like, I said at the very beginning, it feels like one of your central tenets in your book is this notion of you got to be ready to be who you are. And there's so many people who still think that, well, to be a great doctor, I can be a dick.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, I'm just the CEO, I've got to do that. And it doesn't matter how I do things almost. At home, I'm a lovely person. At work, I'm a dick, or vice versa. And it feels like those type of discourses are bound for illness.
I agree. And I think that when you are misaligned in that sense, that it does come back in a way. It's like I heard it described as, you know, there's this love, which is it's like a life force. And when you damn it, you know, when you dampen it and you damn it like waters, like a big wall, it will break out at some point. And so you can't dampen the inner self that kind of wants to be expressed. And I think it does come out maybe as a heart attack or an illness or something that kind of breaks in you, or you will just feel this sense of, you know, longing, a sense that I can never feel whatever hole I'm feeling, no matter how successful,
right,
how much money, you know, yeah, how many external accolades, how many awards, why do I still feel this just a gnawing little sense of something? And so I would pay attention to that, because that's data, as I was talking about, this idea of what am I feeling or thinking deep down. That's data. So as much as I'm talking about data on the outside, I'm talking about your internal felt sense and going, it's giving me a signal of something. But of course, you know, you need to be fairly quiet, don't you, Minta, to feel it? And that's the work, because we are filling our lives with a lot of things. I am
busyness.
Absolutely a person who does, who, you know, has a full dance card. And so am I giving myself a chance to catch up? And very often after, you know, 6 months, I go, no, I'm in my head. And so
after 6 months,
I take myself away now, Minta. And I think this year I found myself in that state. I was feeling in May, oh, I'm so in my head. I'm ruminating. I don't feel like myself. I might have lost my joy and I couldn't get it back. I'm a biohacker. And I could not biohack my way out of this. I tried everything and I was still feeling stressed. So that's my indicator. I'm stressed and I'm not being my nicest self at the moment, but mainly to my nearest and dearest. So what's going on? And I happened to have booked to come to the US and to go straight to Omega Institute and to learn Qigong. You know, it's like a cousin of Tai Chi. Yeah, with Robert Peng, and because it's body work. So I went and did that, learned with Robert Peng, met beautiful people and ate healthily. And wow, do you know, halfway through I was walking through this garden, which I'd just kind of walked through because I needed to walk through it to get to where I needed to go to. And I was just looked at this little bee playing across these flowers and I noticed it. And I thought, I'm back.
I love it.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
What was interesting for me about that, Lisa, was, well, first of all, you basically you're giving permission not to have to do the daily check, because you sort of said, well, at 6 months, I got it. Because otherwise, if we're in this constant checking mode, it's like you don't get off the pot.
Yeah. And I guess what do you mean by checking? Because let's look into that. I wonder what do you think is normally the practice with checking, do you think?
Well, I think that most people don't check in. They're in this running mode. They're doing
just
mode.
Just the they're doing. So they're in doing,
Yeah, not the being. And so I personally find it really useful to have a time when I set my day on the right path. So I have now a pretty solid regime that just 10 to 20 minutes. And I stretch because I am a very stiff old man nowadays. and I thought that it would be a metaphor for what I needed to do, which is become more flexible.
Yeah, love it. Oh, nice.
Where we have all our wiring, you know, as you get older, it's more entrenched. And the idea of I can now kiss my toes, which I could only do last when I was a baby.
And what a lovely way of putting it.
And then I listen to my body, and I'm trying to get much more in touch, and it's something I've been poor at in the past. But so that's like in on a daily basis. But at the same time, like, you don't have this big check in, sort of like where you go to a hotel and you check in, and this is my life. Because if you're constantly meta observing your life, then you struggle to live it.
Can I pick up 2 points on that? I love that. And I love kissing your toes. Oh, okay. The first part to talk about is that idea of a morning routine or some sort of routine or practice which nurtures and nourishes you. And absolutely, you use the data in your life to build something which absolutely suits you. So I think the thing about a practice is not to listen to somebody else's practice, because I actually get up really early. So before our conversation, even though we started at 6, I built in getting up at 5 a.m. So if we were going to have a conversation at 5, I would have got up at 4, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I had an hour. And I do my Qigong. I have a practice of getting into my body as well. And for me, you mentioned the flexibility. So for me, it's about becoming aware of my energy and connecting to or grounding myself away from this busy head. Because I wake up with, you know, ideas already. And so I'm just doing a practice to do that. So that's the morning routine. And I have always had a morning routine, which I just love, and it's quite long, like it took me an hour. The second part is, and this is something I'm actually working on, like it's like a something that I'm trying to do more regularly, which is an awareness practice, Minta, of, it's an informal mindfulness practice that just has, and I think I'm trying to make it subconscious, like a habit of just the bringing awareness to, as you're saying, that meta state of the world is disrupted and chaotic, but actually I'm okay. You know, bringing awareness to, in this moment I'm fine, you know, or bringing awareness to physiological signs, hungry, angry, you know,
tired.
And then thinking, oh, okay, so no big decisions now. So at the end of the day, because I get up so early, I'm pretty spent. My battery's quite low. Resilience is low. Oh, am I feeling triggered because I just need to pack myself up and go home? So that's my two sort of builds on what you shared, which is, I do think, you know, like I'm not leaving it for 6 months, not even thinking about it, but just daily awareness, even especially being triggered, Minta. I mean, I think I do a lot of facilitation of offsides, but instead of thinking as a group, as a one big blob, you know, I'm looking at the humans that make up the group or team and trying to absolutely see each person exactly who they are, as exactly who they are. And in doing that, I think, you know, that when you're looking at people as individuals with all of our hopes, dreams and fears, that very often we are conditioned to save ourselves, help ourselves in childhood or later in life. And very often we can be triggered, as you know, just to accidentally jump back into that protective self. And so I'm just looking for evidence of that, just to go, is this really the data that I was given? So Minta or somebody else said something that made me feel something, like my inference from the data of your words was way more emotional, had way more sting and the actual words and possibly your intention.
Right.
So I might flare. Do you want me to give you an example? It's kind of embarrassing. Okay.
Try.
I had not been invited to a particular gathering at my old college, but I wanted to catch up with someone and they said that they were going to be there, so maybe I could just drop in. So basically, you know, I was just gate crashing.
Right.
So there's a gathering and he wasn't there yet. So I kind of was there without him. And so I was just sort of milling around and someone sort of came up to me and we formed a little group and it was chit chat. And she said, are you starting or are you finishing? Okay. So she said, are you starting or finishing? Now, remember, so where I was in my old college, now I am 51, but I look a lot younger. I'm really, really tiny. I have a bit of a thing around people thinking that I'm younger than I am. Right. Are you starting or are you finishing? And so I'm like, bloody hell. She thinks that I'm still at college.
Yeah, 30 years
ago.
I
flared big time. And I'm like, well, actually, I started college in 1990 and I finished in 1993. And so it was obvious that I was pissed off. So she promptly left the group, right? Anyway, so she's kind of mills herself off, right? And then a friend of mine, so this guy who I was meant to see, he's still not there. So and a friend of mine who happened to be there, she comes up to me and she goes, Lisa, I haven't seen you in ages. Are you starting? Are you finishing? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Turns out this is a prestigious mentor. I'm talking like big time ethics leadership scholarship for incredible people who were very advanced in their careers to learn about leading Australia. Are you starting or are you finishing? Because it was graduation of these amazing people. That first lady thought I was one of the amazing scholarship people. Right?
Yeah.
Can you see the data? Are you starting or are you finishing? There's a ladder of inference. Roger Schwartz teaches this. So the ladder of inference is like a step ladder. And I went all the way up my ladder of inference until I was on to. No, it was just that the data triggered my conditioning of, oh, bloody hell, everyone thinks I'm so young.
Yeah.
And can you see how I then went all the way up the ladder,
very
far away from the actual her intention. And I didn't ask her the next question. What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Well, it's so, like assuming innocence, right? It's assuming that there's an innocence in that question and the filter.
Assume the best intentions or just be curious. I lost my curiosity. I mean, the thing that I say is my superpower.
Right. And I was interested about the type of interviews you hold. I think it's relevant in off mic, if you will, is or the sessions that you run where you have multiple individuals. How do you, what tips or tricks do you have before you enter in a room where you have to work the room, or before an interview where you want to get to that zany, interesting, deep dive question?
Yeah,
because in the end of the day, you can prepare, but somehow there's an element of this which is deeply human.
Yeah. So I'll take that in two parts because in the facilitation, so when I'm facilitating, as you say, you know, a group of people, if it's not too unwieldy, so we're not talking thousands of people, so but it could be up to 100, I will get a list of all the participants and I will actually look at their LinkedIn or their, you know, as much as I can about them and just try and get a sense of who is the person coming into this room, a felt sense of maybe, you know, whether they've stayed in Australia the whole time or moved from somewhere, just a really nice sense. So I definitely do the research and see, once again, see each people as each person as a person. And then I prepare my intention for them, not for myself. So that idea of how would I love them to feel? What are they feeling now? How would I like them to feel as a result of this one day together? And I start building a safe container as soon as they get in the room. So I don't expect people to embarrass themselves or do zany things. You know, I let the trust and the safety build, and from that natural humor and levity comes out, and I let it breathe and I let it come from them. So that's the first part, is that when you give people permission, you know, I'm pretty daggy, so, you know, pretty dorky. When you give people permission, then they can be that freer self. So that's one thing. The for interviews, you know, once again, we learned in radio school, prepare to be spontaneous, prepare to be spontaneous. So yes, you're doing your prep again. I would always read the person's book. And for me, it's not just about the content of the book, but it's an empathy exercise for me. So, you know, I'm getting a sense of this person through their words and through their thoughts and, once again, their hopes and dreams and fears, just through the essence of the book. So I would prepare that and then hold it lightly, to use that phrase again, because if you overly prepare and if you hold it too tightly, you're going to miss that human connection.
Yeah, if it's too scripted.
Yeah, if it's too scripted. And then there's a little courage point here. So when you're in that moment of facilitating or interviewing, can you be in that moment and trust that you'll have that next question or that something will happen, rather than overly needing to prepare what you are going to say next? But that's a lifetime, you know, piece of work around what I say, listening with every pore of your body.
And I think that's a kind of skill we could do with more of off radio. I mean, amongst ourselves, that ability to listen to what the other person's saying, go with them down the rabbit hole that they're saying and their feelings, and focus in on them rather than bring it back to me.
Yeah, and Minta, you know, it's funny because I sometimes talk about, you know, interviewing skills or techniques, but actually I don't really believe in that. So if it's helpful for people, then I can try and distill things into skills. But the thing about the listening piece or the interviewing piece is I lean a little bit, or what I find helpful in terms of frameworks is Dr. Dan Siegel's work on interpersonal neurobiology. So he's got these beautiful phrases. One is attunement, and then the other one is resonance. So attunement is that, you know, when we first start talking, it's like I'm trying to tune into your wavelength, trying to get Minta. So tune, and then resonance is actually where we start getting into sync a little bit. Okay, and then that's the beautiful part where we're exchanging. So it is a two-way thing. It's still a human connection. It's not that I'm playing a role and you're playing a role. It's that we're sort of in, you know, resonance together. Another way, I playfully call it mind jazz, because you've got your instrument. That's Minta's instrument, very unique to you. I'm playing my instrument. I'm not reaching over and playing your instrument. I don't have to be you or, you know, like, you know, mirror you. You're right. Minta, and then mine jazz. Yeah. So I'm going to, I'm playing a tune here. You're picking it up, and then you're doing your own little riff. And that's what I think is a beautiful conversation, is when you're both playing mind jazz.
Yeah, well, what it suggests, I think, is that inevitably, as the interviewer, you are also bringing something to the table.
I think so. I think when I'm doing an interview for a broadcast, I think in that conversation, I would generally be keeping it shorter, obviously, for my thing. And I would only probably share things if I thought, well, this is useful for the conversation. And definitely playing around with, sometimes, you know, short questions are, you know, really nice, you know, the ooh, why, or, you know, tell me more, you know, those types of things. So I think when it comes to the interviewing format, particularly if you've got an expert, then, you know, definitely it wouldn't be like 50-50 airtime.
No. Yeah. I when I look at my tracks, I tend to try to stay under about 20% of the amount of time. So I do think of that, because sometimes I want to tell stories, and stories are okay to share. They can trigger other thoughts and stories. Yeah. So there are a few things I wanted to, you have so many wonderful things in your book, and I, I don't know which ones we're going to be able to get to, but one of the things is this idea of a portfolio career. It's not a piece of cake, as you write. It seemed like time management is a fundamental element of that. Being punctual seemed to be a fundamental element to you. Do you think portfolio careers are for most people, some people, weird people?
So this concept I loved when it was shared with me by Dori Clark, who is a coach in the US.
I know Dori. She's been on my show a few times.
And when she shared it to me, I loved it because we talk about side hustles and there's different ways of looking at people who don't just have one full-time job, basically. You've got a portfolio of things that you do which make up a career. That's the way of looking at it. And like an investment portfolio, it's like you're diversifying your interests. Mm. So Dori does it because it gives you longevity in terms of your career. As we saw with COVID, you know, if one thing drops off, then you've still got something else. So that's the concept. I like it because, you know, we talk about bringing our whole selves to work, and sometimes your whole self can't be in flow with one job. So for people who kind of have different interests and who feel like, well, you know, and I would say maybe it is a lot of us, you know, we have many different things that we do. I see a portfolio career as an additive thing, not a destructive thing. So when I'm broadcasting live broadcast radio on a Sunday and I've got This Working Life, which is a podcast, highly produced show, I see that when I do those two things, they add up and make me a better listener, interviewer. And then I also do facilitation at offsites, as I said. That also helps me because then I'm also in the real world. So I can then bring that into my show as well. So that's what I call, and that's my mindset around a portfolio career, so that I don't feel like I'm being pulled or there's tension. So that's one thing. Practically, when you talk about time. So in radio, we learn how to time out. So when it comes to the top of the clock, the ABC theme will play, and it plays regardless of whether I'm ready or not, right? So I can start a sentence and know 10 seconds, 20 seconds. Before that, I was always punctual. I think it is for your own good, but also a respect thing for everyone else. And also I use time blocking in a practical way. Have you heard of that?
I have.
You know, it's, yeah. So near aisle.
And the color coding.
I do the color coding. So if you look at my diary, I bet you our diaries look the same. So every single hour is kind of blocked out, and as you say, in color. So the blue for me is transiting to places, but also rest, recovery. And when you look at my diary, it kind of looks frightening because it looks like I have no spare time. But actually, I'm just blocking out the health things first. So healthy things are yellow. You know, the transiting is blue. And I transit by riding my bike. So actually, I've got quite a balanced life, even though it looks frightening for everyone else.
Well, that's a moment where you're transiting and doing a little bit of health.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that's what I think is a portfolio career, but it just happens to suit me as well because I'm just innately curious and I like to start things.
Yeah, you're also very active, right? And so yeah. You have that desire for many things. You've got many talents, many skills, and you would feel probably closed in if you just had one thing to do.
Yeah, totally. So it works for me.
It speaks to another element which you write about, which I really enjoyed, and I thought it was very refreshing, work-life coherence rather than this notion of balance, which I've always thought is misplaced. You mentioned before, like, this is something that maybe many people do. I think it's probably not everybody, because I think I have seen a lot, done a lot. We've been very privileged. And we've been allowed to do much more than just be a builder or something like that. So the idea of balance, especially we have ambition, is a tough thing to actually settle down. It's hard to succeed at everything. But work-life coherence really resonated for me. How do you come up with that? What does your work-life coherence look like?
Yeah, so work-life balance, I feel like it just puts too much pressure on us. And then, you know, is there any real delineation? I'm not sure. So we left that behind. There is the concept of work-life integration, which is, that's a nice word as well. Coherence is kind of, so it comes from heart coherence. It's a physiological term, and it's always moving. Like, it's kind of like little movements of that sense of it actually is working as a whole.
It's organic.
It's organic. And you know that concept of job crafting? So Amy Ranewski, she has done a whole body of research. Her life work is on the fact that we have more agency in our jobs than we think. And what's interesting about her work, so it looks at relationship crafting. So who do you kind of work in relationship with? It looks at task crafting. So what are you doing in the day? And then cognitive crafting, like how am I viewing my work? The thing about her work, which is fascinating, is that one example is hospital cleaners. The happier hospital cleaners saw their role when they were asked to describe it as, I help people heal. And it's just a beautiful, I help people heal faster and with more love, right? The sadder hospital cleaners, I empty the waste paper basket, you know, I do blah, blah, blah. So she had so much power in, no matter what you're doing, you can be happier when you see the agency. So even when you are working in a job that people might think is really restrictive, she says her research shows that people will find a way when they want to be in flow. So it's kind of a mini challenge, I think, a compassionate challenge, Minta, for people who think, I'm just going to do my job. It's just a job. And then I will live my life outside that, because you spend a lot of time at work. And once again, that misalignment of I'm going to be incredibly, incredibly unhappy, you know, for the 10 hours, 7 hours, 5 hours I'm at work, that's a lot of your life to waste.
It so strikes me.
Work-life coherence is trying to address that.
Sorry, it strikes me that that idea of agency, I feel it is incumbent upon the hierarchy to wish to allow for agency, to guide people to understand that they're doing something bigger than just cleaning the trash. Because I would suspect that a lot of people will feel that they don't have agency because they are mismanaged. They're overwrought. They're just told, all you do is got to clean the bloody. The idea of a person in the hospital who can come up with that kind of a purpose as an enlightened individual. And I think it is important for us, even like when you're walking into a room, like you were saying with a seminar, bring them to that place. Allow them to feel the authority to come up with something bigger. But that has to be known. Right? Because if that individual in the hospital has that idea, but no one else understands it that way.
Well, I mean, what's really interesting is in her research, it shows that these enlightened individuals will do it whether or not it is there is an imprimatur to do so. And often they might even bend the rules. So one of the rules is, say it was like no visitors at this time, or you are not allowed to change the paintings on the wall. The hospital cleaner just changed the paintings anyway, or just let the, you know, people sneak in. So there, in her research, it says it happens whether or not you want it to, and it doesn't matter what the managers think. However, I think imagine if organisations were enlightened as those individuals, then of course that's a beautiful, flourishing organisation. And there are organisations that are like that. And that, of course, then more people will be job crafting and enjoying, and then their retention rates will be higher. Mm-hmm. So that is the difference between an organization which is losing people, because after a while, of course, these, you know, people may leave, right?
The paycheck isn't enough.
Yeah. So especially if it's a toxic environment. So, you know, I don't think there's anything, you know, in my thoughts or in the book or in the world that says you need to stay or you should stay in a toxic environment, because the thing about toxic environments is you, an individual, can't change that. So you might go in there thinking that you're the silver bullet, even if you're the kind of lead, one of the leaders, but actually you kind of change to the environment. So sometimes it's better to leave.
Well, it's like we were saying before, and you talk about how you got shingles. I myself got type 1 diabetes for not being in the right place. So, you know, it can have real consequences on your health, that kind of toxicity. I mean, that's what toxic means, right? It's sickening. Yeah. Last thing I want to talk about, just for the few minutes we have left. I mean, there's so many other things I wanted to get into, but I'm going to leave it with this or work in this space. It seems so important for you, notion of time, not just management, but past, present, and future. There are several times you talk about it. Specifically, you were saying about how your father informed you that the future is rooted in your past. And then you have other moments where you were quoting Greta Bradman, who talks about how our values come from basically past, present, and future. So I don't know how you want to riff on that, but it seems like not just time, but time, present, past, and future is also important for you.
Yeah, I think in that work or the coaching work that I do, I think I recognize through having conversations with people how rooted we are in our past and how it plays out sometimes in the present, and really just bringing awareness to that. So, you know, we talked about being punctual. Well, I always thought it was just because Dad told us to be punctual. So I knew that it came from Dad. He taught us we were always early for every single party, right? And I just thought, oh, well, that's because Dad is a punctual person. No, I found out that it's because his brother used to have to pick him up. So he came from a very poor Malaysian country town called Ampang, but his brother used to have to cycle from work from Kuala Lumpur, come all the way, and he was often late. And Dad, you know, everyone had gone home. He was a tiny little boy, and he was so scared, and he used to have to hide behind the big trees and wait for his brother for hours and hours until it was dark and he was alone. And then his brother would come hours later, and that feeling of being scared, that's why he's always on time and early, because he hated that feeling. So knowing that, I'm like, oh my God, this is like really pretty, it was a fear-based response from Dad. So I have a choice, Minta, and that is that, because I can get really anxious, stressed about being late, but at what cost? So I'm not running for a bus. I'm not running for a tram. I've got to understand that actually those decisions are really important, and I'd rather arrive and be late than not arrive at all, because I have had friends running for a bus and unfortunately being killed by running, you know, doing a dangerous act because they didn't
or driving too fast.
Yeah, all those things, right? So it can also free you. It's not shackles.
Well, what I like a lot about what you said, Lisa, is this notion of nuance. There are various constructs you have, but it seems to be a lot of it is working in the middle. You work it well, Lisa. So for anyone who's listening, how can they get in touch with your work, Lisa? I'm not going to ask them to personalize that, but what would be the best way to get your book, read what you do, stay in touch, see what you do for a living in terms of your portfolio of material?
So I'm quite active on LinkedIn. I've found that's a good place for me, given that a lot of my work is, it's good for, you know, a lot of the thoughts that I have. So I put a lot of thoughts on LinkedIn and Instagram as well under Lisa Leong. I think I've got an S in the middle, so Lisa S. Leong. And website as well, lisaleong.net, which is coming soon.
Oh, nice. Well, I'll put all that and a link, of course, to your book. Which do you prefer, Schlanger or Quiet Flower?
Ah, love it. Yes, I do have some very random nicknames. As I mentioned, middle name starts with S. So S. Leong is Schlonger. There you go. That was my college nickname, and it makes me laugh. And then Quiet Flower, because obviously I'm not very quiet. It was given to me as a Chinese name when I was in Asia leading a team. And so somebody did that ironically, haha. And so but the name is beautiful. It's Jinghua, Quiet Flower. Yeah, but then people would laugh when they saw my name.
On those lovely laughing words, Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Minta. What a great conversation.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minta Dialogue podcast. If you like the show and would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MintaDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on MintaDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
A stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust is the reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hopeful you respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die suburb. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust in my reason, and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man.
I'm ready, fire and arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th-century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th-century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.